Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. As we've got a big agenda, I'll try and rattle along as quickly as possible. The minutes have been circulated on the 16th of October. Does anyone have any amendments to the minutes? Comments thereon? Do I have your permission to sign them as a true record then?
Yes.
Okay, Jim. Thank you.
Have we any apologies?
We do. Apologies received from Councillor Rooksell, who is substituted tonight by Councillor Rose.
We'll move on to the officers' reports. Statement of accounts 2021 and 22-23. 21-22-23. Please.
So these are the late accounts. We managed to catch up and get 2 years worth of accounts completed now. This was a key recommendation in the Value for Money report, the section 24 that we had issued in February last year. So getting these done is a big step forward for the authority. It was a Herculean effort, and it was led by Emma and my team, and everyone there worked extremely hard to get these churned out in time. We are compliant with the backstop legislation, which is covered off in some detail in the report. But effectively, we had a cut-off date, we had to stand by, get a 30-day consultation in, and have these signed off before. We are going to be compliant with that legislation, so we will not be on any kind of naughty step or any kind of reporting from central government, which is a real worry for us earlier in the year, and a big step forwards. As the report also notes, we have to get the 23-24 accounts out now, and we need to get those done by early January to give ourselves the 30 days consultation with the public, and then allow our external auditors the opportunity to have a look at those, and again issue a modified audit opinion. So I won't go into detail around to the audit opinion types, because that's more in the next report around Grant Thornton's modified audit opinions, but it's a really big step forward. I can't stress how much work it took to get 2 years, well, 4 years worth of accounts done in a matter of months, because we did the same two for accounts as well.
Could I just ask when this committee will get to look at those accounts?
23-24?
Yeah.
Early January, we're going to have them done by.
Could you be more specific?
Not at the moment, no. We are just trying to work through them at the moment.
I'll let you know when I'm on holiday.
Oh, okay.
Can we commend the work of the officers?
Yes.
And all those involved in producing the report, producing it on time as well?
I was glad to hear that recommendation, and so will they after the last half an hour that they just had grilling.
Right.
Have I a seconder for that motion? All in favour? Thank you very much from the committee for all the work that you're doing in very difficult circumstances, and ones which are making it doubly difficult with the environment that you're working in. So please keep up the good work in spite of all the difficulties that you're facing, and more that are going to be coming along.
Yes,
definitely. Right then. Do you want to quickly take us through your report?
In terms of the safety council?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, fundamentally, key issues are that we wanted to make sure we got these accounts out in time. The detail is around this is backlog audits are a national issue. So there's been a lot more pressure on councils to do more work around fixed asset testing, around the pensions, valuations, and some of the technical financial instrument valuations, which are extremely difficult to do. And to be transparent, don't make sense in the public sector. These are artificial constructs. They exist in the private sector because obviously your assets deliver the value of your business and product. In the public sector, that's just not true. Our assets aren't treated in the same way, so value of our assets has no meaning. But it takes up the bulk of our audit time now. So this put huge amounts of pressure on the sector as a whole to be able to do it. The local audit firms haven't been able to get enough resources in to be able to conduct such complex audits and do them within the time scale set by government as well. That's well documented. And that's despite them being able to pay substantially more than us, recruiting extremely hard into the sector. They just haven't been able to plug those gaps either. And there's issues with authorities making large cuts to raise our funding reductions. So we are all aware of the gaps in the finance team at the moment. We went out to recruit, we were unsuccessful, we're going to go out again with a supplement. We are not necessarily that hopeful. We're going to do it and hope for the best, but again, even with supplements on top, we aren't competing with the private sector. There is really that lack of shortage of chartered accountants right now, and particularly ones with experience at the right level and the level of experience on complex instruments. We do a lot of things here that you wouldn't do in a smaller private sector business. That's pretty straightforward with the various cost units and spreading it. We do a lot of different activities like refuse collection, leisure, so on and so forth, and they don't operate in a business way. So it's a very different thing. Obviously you get it to the big firms, they do vastly more complex financial instruments for their hedging, what have you, but to a medium-sized business or smaller, you would not. The government's response to clear the backlog was to set these specific dates and allow auditors to issue modified opinions. It's very important to not to see these modified opinions as a negative issue, as long as it states in the modified opinion it's because they haven't had sufficient time to audit the accounts. Our opinions in the grant for audit section, if I take them together, do state it's because they haven't had time to do the audit. It's not because of financial improprieties, we didn't provide information, that we missed deadlines, that there's anything we'll provide was illegal going on either. So it wasn't any of those issues, it was a capacity issue. We were late doing it, they haven't got the resources, we haven't got the resources, and that's been reflected in the report. Also in the report, it does reflect the February Section 24 report, so that is detailed again, but it's not a panic in terms of it is the exact same recommendations repeated again. They just haven't had time or haven't chosen to revisit those as part of this issuance of their memorandum. We've got in 5.6 the deadlines for the backstop dates. We can see the 28th of February one, the 23-24. So that's why we're trying to get our accounts done for early January, so we can go out for 30 days and have time to bring it through the audit committee cycle and get it all done by that 28th of February deadline. We have brought an additional resource, a consultant, who is working exclusively on the accounts now. She has today been working on the balance sheet. We've got the capital entries in. We've also got the pension entries in. So she's making good progress. It just leaves the CIES core entries, a number of the core notes, senior officer accounts. So fundamentally, we've got a large number of the big entries in, the high value ones already. So it'll be those little tweaks towards the end that we need to get done. And we hit the 23-24. 24-25, we've got till February again. But we don't want to be hitting that deadline. We want to be earlier next year. We want to start resetting the chunks of the accounts. So even if we run to it, we'd like to get certainty so that we will get a partial modification on our opinion. So maybe the CIS isn't audited, but we do audit the reserves, we do audit assets, for example, and we have set aside monies to reset the fixed assets next year to revalue the entirety of them. So we would only have a modified opinion on an element of the accounts. And then we're planning to do that piece by piece over the next 4 to 5 years to get them back up to date and get full reassurance over our statement of accounts going forwards. And that is something we have discussed at length with the ZETs on human external auditors. And they're very comfortable with that approach because they have a large number of other authorities in the same position who will all be trying to reset at the same time, and there's only so many auditors in the sector, so it would be unreasonable to expect them to try and do it at the same time. And for us, when we do this, we'll be trying to get 3 years of audits done in one go on the areas that we aren't having modified opinions on. So that's going to be a substantial amount of work for the team, 3 years worth of audits. So we can see that from 24-25-27-28, the unaudited accounts draft will move from 31st of May to 30th of June, following the financial year to which they relate. I don't know if everyone was here back in the mid-2010s, but the government's kept moving forward the publication dates. They kept putting more and more pressure on councils and finance teams. I think they've realised now, with all of the regeneration schemes they keep pushing down, the grants they do, the additional pressures from things like DFG, social care, planning, the local, all of these things, they couldn't keep pushing us to be earlier and earlier. So I think they're starting to reset it and realise they need to be a lot more realistic with the scale of their ask for us, or give us a huge amount more money so I can compete with PwC and Grant Thornton and salary structures. But I don't see them doing that because that would be crazy. So, put them up. It's not an adverse opinion, which is great, and it's not a unmodified opinion, which would be really good to do, but we can't do it. So, fundamentally, that's the reason we're going to do.
Remind me, Jim, what are we asked to do?
So we're asked,
members have got to note.
Yes, please, one down to four.
So we're asked under 2.1 to note the four items there: statement of the 21-22 accounts, appendix 1, a statement of the 22-23 accounts, appendix 2, findings of the external auditor, agenda item number 5.
It's actually 3B, Chan.
It's actually 3B.
It's the fifth item down, but it's 3B.
Right, so it's the fifth one down, but it's 3B.
Yes, please.
And note the impact of the audit backlog legislation. Has anyone got any questions? Angela.
Chair, I think bearing in mind, you know, the comments that Chris is making about the government putting more and more pressure on the finance teams, and yet they themselves are late with their grants every year. You know, we're all hanging on the teeth waiting for them to come up with how much money they're going to actually give to the local authorities. We think that it's taken them an awful long time to actually realise that they should be clearing their own doorstep before they start criticising the local authorities as much as they do.
You're quite right, because I remember we did have a number of discussions about how do you put a budget together when you don't actually know what your income is going to be. Because the government hadn't told you yet, and you're only 3 months away from the start date.
Quite.
But you can have it the other way around as well, as I've been saying, is that if you're running a business of the size and you're managing a lot of money, you do need management control accounts so you know what money you're spending. And we've been done a lot of work on improving that recently, as I'm sure we'll talk about later.
Do we ask a question about the audit report now or later?
Which one?
The one with the IT audit report, right at the end of the paper, the audit report.
That's
what
page are you on?
It's not going to come up anywhere else.
Oh, okay.
Except under item 3B. So we can, if everybody's happy with noting those, we can move on to item 3B now.
Chairman, I think I've got a question.
I've got a question about the account, but it's not for not noting.
Yeah.
It's just for my personal knowledge. For the pensions, you said that
the pensions. It's
page 16-17. As said, the pension figures include the Freedom Leisure contributions.
Yes.
I would like to know, is Freedom Leisure exclusively working for the council?
No, they are a national provider of leisure services.
Okay, so how do you know if someone is working for them and leaving them? Do you know it, or?
So it will be within the terms.
No, it's just controlling.
No, it's within the terms of our contract. We know the employees that are working within our leisure centres on behalf of Freedom on the contract.
Okay, so you know who they are. Okay, no problem. Another question. Yes, on the account, page 115, and it's also on the next account. When you say hosted in the account, I don't know what it is. It's just a
Could you point us at the numbers?
Page 115.
So these are our hosted services, so we might be hosting channels or accounts, might be hosting some staff as the shared service.
Okay, I understand. That's
all. Oh, okay.
Okay. Thank you. Just
I'd welcome a challenge.
But then I notice also you have, which is quite good, the pension, you reduce the liability.
Yes.
Which is good.
It's looking like it's a bit early, but it's looking like it will be fully funded. So that should reduce the amount of pension contributions we're making in future years. We've done very well with our investments, the growth in the stock market, and with the profiling of our staff. But there is a risk that we're not getting enough new recruits coming in joining the pension scheme, so that will remove the burden of the pensioners who've left early and so on and so forth onto a fewer people. But that's a national problem as well.
Yeah.
Just defined benefit nature of our pensions.
Yeah, it's been a feature of the last 3 or 4 years with the improvement in overall interest rates on government gilts. That it's made the burden of future pensions reduced dramatically. Also the growth in longevity stabilised, in fact I think it actually decreased slightly during COVID, which impacts enormously as well on the cost of a pension scheme. So without us doing actually anything, the whole pension field has improved markedly. Sorry, that's just an aside.
Yeah. No, I was asking the question about, well, I was just noticing it.
Yeah.
Because before I became a counsellor, I looked at the accounts, you know, on the website, and I thought, it was something like 50 million around. I said,
Yeah,
it was quite.
And so it's actually amazing just how fast it's moved from a huge deficit to actually break even or even a bit better.
Yeah.
I doubt if we will get a reduction in contributions in the immediate future though.
Your actuaries alike.
Yeah. Once we've been having surpluses for 10 years, they might actually do something about it. So, any more questions, Karen?
No.
So, all in favour of noting the reports then? So, final external audit reports, item 3B, which is on the separate paper. Quite a lot of detail in here from Grant Thornton. Much of it you may remember from the section 24 notice that we got before the last meeting, or last but one meeting. And Chris has reminded me that much of the content within their report is just a repeat of the section 24 information. I believe I'm right there, Chris.
All this, yes, in that first section, it's just the IT report, so
definitely. Yeah. Perhaps then, unless anyone's got any questions on this repeated information from section 24, we'll move on to the IT bit, which is new. So Chris, if you could tell us about the new bit.
So we've had discussions internally. Throughout that reported stage, we didn't respond. We believe we responded. It may be a case of it got lost in the mix because we responded nearly a year ago to this. So we are a little bit of disagreement, but we're not going to do anything drastic or blunt because this is the end of our relationship with Grant Thornton. These are the last reports we'll see from them. they're gone now, so there isn't much value in that kind of debate at this point in time. And to be fair, we have put our own comments into the report. You can see them all in there now. It's largely been rectified there and thereabouts. So we didn't feel like it was that controversial in the end. I didn't want to have a disagreement or force them to rewrite it or do anything at this point in time. Just wanted to get those management letters signed off and just move forward with our new auditors as ETs, to be honest. So I'm not going to, I could get into the detail, but fundamentally they hired some issues, we disagreed with it fundamentally, we sent back our responses, they supplied a report that suggested that we hadn't, we've now put our responses in anyway, and that's where we are.
Okay, and if I can just add to that, our new external auditors will be picking it up and following up on it anyway, so if there are any other issues, we'll pick it up.
Right. So we have the comfort of knowing that the things that we have to do have been noted by our new auditors. They are in their work programme to look at and check. And we're all quite happy that we are going to be able to meet their expectations. I understand. Judith's nodding. Is everybody noticing that Judith's nodding? Sorry.
I just wish to ask a question on the Civica finance system. I noticed at times it said they manage the finance system. I just wondered how it worked, you know, because you say things are in there by new users and things like that are done by them. I just wondered what the relation, how it worked when I read it.
Can do.
In
terms of the Civica financial system, it is software as a service. They maintain the software for us, they do updates or what have you. We work with them on the implementation of patches. I have two people in my team that work on this, on the system, and sort out passwords, sorting out people's access, when they join, when they leave, and so on and so forth. They're put into IT. So this is where we do have some disagreements around the details.
Yeah, that's what I meant in the audit reports and things like that. Mm. AD, that's not a practice directory. Do they manage that as well? Because it sort of set implied that in what I read. I'm not sure if they do or not.
I won't profess to be an expert on that part of it, but there's kind of like three parties involved in all of this. So we've got Civica themselves, and they're responsible kind of the hosting and security in the cloud. We do our local administration within the finance team, but then my technology team as well. Mm. They control access to the network and certain other functions, so you couldn't actually directly get onto our finance system unless you've got access to our network anyway. So we set people up initially as a user, and then the finance team would then narrow that down and allow you onto their part of the system. So you need two parts to get onto it. Mm-hmm.
But you actually raise them, people, you don't send it up to Civica to
No, all of that's done, as I say, either within the technology team or within the finance team. There's an element of that cuts across both of our teams, but no, that doesn't go up to Civica. That's more kind of given the controls more associated with the security and the infrastructure.
I'm just a bit confused when I'm reading it, who did what happened.
It isn't that straightforward.
Any other questions on this part of the report? There are two letters within that report at the back of the Grant Thornton section, just before we get to the report on the IT audit, which ask the annual governance statement. I don't know what the pages are on the computer generated one. Do we know, Jim?
It's not page number, unfortunately, Chairman. Right. It's sort of about approximately halfway through, I suggest.
Is the one page 19 and 38, the last one?
It's the pages immediately before the IT audit findings report, which is that one, there are two letters where we are asked to give our approval as the Council's Audit and Accounts Committee. They're the four pages immediately before the IT.
Does it say commercial and content to the top of that page?
Yes, it does say that. Letter to be written on client headed notepaper.
I guess that's our headed notepaper.
Yeah.
I think it's page 15 of 22 of the separate document, isn't it?
It is. It is the separate document, you're right.
It's assumed that we approve this because it says at the bottom the approval of this letter was representation was minuted
at its meeting of 20th of November 24, which is today. The letter they want to see from us. Do our officers have any comment on these two letters?
I signed my bit of money.
Propose that you sign them then, Mr. Chairman.
Anybody seconding that? Or could I take a vote so I know who's committing me for doing this? I'm not going to ask for a named vote, so I can come back to you all. So that's unanimous then.
Unanimous, yes.
So when Judith produces the letters, you've got them. I'll sign them after the meeting. Yeah. As Chris is saying, he's already signed his. Okay, any other comments on the audit findings on the IT?
Disappointed Grant Thornton wasn't here tonight.
Chris, you did make a comment earlier about when the last time you actually saw anybody from Grant Thornton.
Section 24, so that'd be February time, last time I saw
them. Okay, so that covers off, I think, item 3B, unless anyone's got any other questions. Right, thank you very much. Item 3C, risk management policy.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to go open on this one.
Okay.
And then Stephen will chip in on a couple of bits I might have missed. A couple of things to start with then. The new risk management policy and strategy, they do address one of the actions in the value for money improvement plan, which is on the agenda later. But I think both Stephen and I want to stress that actually, although we had to do it for that, that's not our primary reason for doing it. We recognised that it was overdue, it was in need of updating, and actually, rather than just tinker around the edges on this one, Stephen has done a fundamental review of it, and we are very much looking to beef up our risk management process across the council. So some of the key things that we wanted to sort of mention to the committee as part of doing that, one of the first things is that we'll be moving from reporting twice a year to quarterly, so we'll be doing more regular reporting so that we can keep a better eye on the risk. We've produced a risk appetite statement, which you'll see on page 206, and that sets the risk for the council at a moderate level. But it doesn't mean that the council can't take risks outside of that framework. But what it does mean is if we're looking to take a risk outside of that, then there are specific controls in place to manage that and ensure that the risks have been thoroughly considered before we commit to a course of action. And that would be typically around things like the regeneration schemes, where as well as the risks, there are significant opportunities, and it's where that informed decision needs to be made around whether those opportunities outweigh those risks. So if they're in controlled circumstances, those risks can be taken, but the default is we set it at a moderate level. The other thing we've done, and that's set out on the following pages, is a new risk matrix. the score is on the tablet. So we changed that slightly. We moved from a 4x3 matrix to a 4x4, which will allow us to have more nuances around the scoring for the RITS matrix. Right. We are going to be backing all of this up with training, both for officers and for members. We'll do the invite to all members, but primarily we're looking for members of the Cabinet and members of the Audit and Accounts Committee to attend that, because you're the two that are charged with having oversight of risk management, so it will help with kind of your understanding and give you an opportunity to ask questions on it. Now, the policy itself is going to Cabinet for their approval, but the committee here tonight is welcome to offer a view if you think that appetite has been set at the wrong level, if you're not comfortable with the scoring matrix. If you've got any views, then we can feed those into the Cabinet discussion on that. I think in terms of the status of it, it's probably the level of risk isn't significantly different from the risk that was in the old strategy. It's been expressed in a slightly different way, but we think it's more clearer and hopefully will help to inform decisions as we move forward.
I think that's the key point that Judith's just raised, really. It's whilst it's been a fundamental review, it's to make it easier for officers and members to understand, to see. We're rolling out the training to help particularly Cabinet and Audit Committee, who have defined role within the policy of things that they need to do, but also to raise the profile with officers. And what we're hoping with mandating more risk registers and actually trying to encourage further risk registers that we've actually mandated in the policy, that will have a better understanding of risk when decisions are coming before members, when leadership team are taking delegated decisions, that actually everything is taken not just with financial clarity but with clarity of what the risks might be. As Judith said, it's that risk appetite statement that's probably key driver for us, so that we say our business as usual is this level. We're probably, hopefully, never going to see anything that's in that hungry level, that really risk-taking level. Perhaps where there are really high rewards, but there's also high risks if you do it. But things like the regeneration schemes would be outside of our moderate appetite. But where there is good chance of returns and we've got a good plan, then we should take them to try and improve the area. So things like the work that's currently going on from the Future High Streets Fund and things like that, probably a higher risk than we would normally take, but as long as we're taking that as an informed risk, which perhaps hasn't been as clear in committee reports and things like that in the past, and we perhaps haven't taken those decisions understanding the risk. So really it is to make sure that members get the right information and leadership team get the right information. Behind this there is a toolkit that we've developed as well for officers to work through, with a lot more advice, a lot more guidance how to do it. So we're hoping it's more clarity for managers and we get probably more focused risks, particularly on the strategic risk register. So it might be that we reduce the number of risks that come more regularly to committee, but they are the real big high profile risks that we do want Cabinet and Audit Committee to be monitoring, and perhaps some of the others can drop down to Chris and Greg monitoring on their directorate ones at leadership team level as well.
Yeah. So do you think it would be appropriate that where we do get some of these very large projects that are in the immediate horizon starting to impact, that we get an oversight of the risks that are involved?
We'll come on to that part in the next item, because we've added a new risk to the strategic risk register, which reflects generally the bigger projects that we're doing. We can certainly offer assurance to the committee that individual projects have risk registers, and we do checks on those as part of our audit work. And you see that through the quarterly audit progress report, reference that. If there was a project that we'd audited and wasn't there, you'd see that very overtly in Stephen's team's reports on that.
Okay.
We wouldn't bring the full ones to the committee, they'd be too large. But hopefully you'll see a better interplay between the two new directorate risk registers that we're setting up and the IT risk register which we've now got in place as well.
Okay.
And so we're expecting to see more of an interaction between those and that strategic risk register. So you might see things dropping off, but knowing they've not dropped off a cliff edge, they've just moved on to a different risk register to be managed and you see things rising to the top and coming through into the strategic ones.
I think if I may chair to add to that, as you see in the policy, there's certain responsibilities that we've put on people, and Chris has got a key responsibility at leadership team level and supported by Judith in terms of being a key challenge at leadership team to make sure that things coming through to members and decisions that are coming through have got the right risks in there. But that's not to say it's all on them. It is leadership team as a whole and managers as well. But if things do come through to cabinet, again, if they don't think the risks are set out clear enough or they have questions on the risks, it's cabinet and the portfolio holders' ability to challenge either before they get there or in the pre-meetings and the briefings that happen to make sure that by the time the formal decision is taken at cabinet, we understand the risks and we know. So there's a lot more emphasis on challenge, peer challenge, Chris and Judith at leadership team holding people to account as well. And cabinet members holding people to account so that we make sure that risks are clear before the decision is made. And I think that's a key difference for me in this policy. It's making that more explicit and hopefully helping people to understand that more.
Chris, you were describing to me earlier the amount of work you've been doing on training to try and reduce risk by having better financial management at the operational level. Perhaps you could tell the committee a bit about that.
I can do, Chair. So yes, we started, put together a training session, various slides showing the basics from I've got flowcharts and show you how to do things like accruals, what a journal is, the different types of budget forecasting, so demand-led, if you're going to average it over a year, if it's a regular monthly one divided by 12, so something like salaries, you know what they're going to be roughly each time. Gone down to that level of basics, then roll that training out for the first time. So I've done that with the leadership team, then I'm going to do it with budget managers. Then I want to do another one after a couple of months, which builds on that. So I'll take that one. Hopefully I'll see a change in terms of the monitoring accuracy and what have you, because we're doing that kind of work. And I'll be able to build on and say, well, look, this is where you're getting. I need you to do more seasonal forecasting, or you need to be better at predicting these spikes. This is how you respond to those situations. So we're going to try and spend the next 12 months or so really upskilling our budget managers, using the system more effectively, giving them the tools to do that monitoring and what have you, so that we can ensure that we forecast more accurately. And we would like to get within 4 or 5% of our budgets in terms of our outturn positions over the next few years. It seems a reasonable goal to me. You should be able to work that out as long as you get the budget set up right in the first place. So that's the kind of work we've been doing at the moment.
Angela.
Cheers, I could say I did notice further on there's quite a bit of mentioning about training in particular for officers, but by the same token, not a lot of mention of training for members. And I think you know that whilst we as members of the Audit and Accounts Commission Committee, we haven't had training for a very long time, and I think you know that not only ourselves but sitting in other scrutiny committees, I wonder how much training is required for other members, not only for those of us on audit and accounts. You know, I think a lot of them just don't understand what's going on.
We will put the invitation out to all members that I think we would be more actively encouraging the
Yes.
to happen, you know, but then we will make it an open one, because as you say, there's a listing invitation section in all kind of reports that come through to cabinet, and we do very much want to work with our colleagues on improving the quality of those, because they do need to be able to explain in some detail the risks that the council may be taking, particularly if we've got some of those ones at the higher end. And there's an expectation to offset those opportunities against it. We need to make sure that they are articulated and are understood.
That's good. Thank you, Chair.
It also comes back to management of our business as well, because Chris has been explaining to me that unfortunately in local government, the management that you would normally take as given in a commercial organisation does not exist. So that the recent overspend that we had that was unrecognised for several months until I think we'd spent 600,000 above budget.
Yes.
And my first question, well, who got fired then? all the commercial organisations I've worked in that start at the senior guy and work down. And Chris has explained to me that because we don't normally have that level of control systems, nobody's got fired. Even though it's badly damaged the council's reserves and its ability to meet budgets. And so one of the impacts of the training on monitoring systems, which in general terms are accounting systems, we need to train our people so that they understand them, can use them, can see what the impact will be if we miss our targets, and do something about it a bit sooner. Chris explained that to me in a lot of detail.
Do they do monthly accounts, like where you get budget against actual?
So everyone has real-time dashboards, so right. You log into your budget and you can see your budget in real-time. Loaded that on there now. We're rolling up training to go with it because this has been relatively new set for software had it, but we're all aware of the implementation finance team. So anyone, Project Manager can log on, see real-time their orders, the actual spend to date and so on, anything that's accruals or any kind of commitments. We're also planning to start doing quarterly formal reporting. That's what we're aiming for in the first instance. We've got to be realistic with our pressures. Our first project has got to be getting statement accounts out for February deadline and supporting the regen schemes and finishing off the other BFM stuff. So we're hopeful we can start doing quarterly reporting. So P6 is currently being finalised by Emma and the team. So that'll be the first one you guys have. And that'll be used to deliver the budget position when we do the budget. And then once we've done that, we'll try, we'll do P9, then we'll do R2.
So we are, perhaps you might say belatedly, but we are getting there.
The strategic risk register is being monitored by the leadership team, and it's going to be reported to the cabinet and this committee. How often is it going to be reported? Quarterly or an annual?
Yeah. We're going to move from half year to quarter, so we will see much more regular progress on that.
Okay.
And in terms of monitoring budgets, what is going to be the target time scale on that? Monthly?
In terms of us monitoring them internally?
Yeah.
Quarterly is when we do it formally, but we are watching high risk budgets more closely than others. I simply don't have the staffing to do it all. We've got so many vacancies in that team now, it's becoming a little bit untenable.
So how do we de-risk ourselves by improving the monitoring if we haven't got the people?
We're trying to recruit again. We're going out again for some more junior posts to see if we can get them. But fundamentally, this is what's in the audit reports. I don't know if anyone read the LGA SIPA report as well about the sector. There aren't any people out there now. We can't recruit them in. The trainees haven't come through, and we can't, even the big firms can't recruit them in.
Good evening.
You'll be using a net block, will you? Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Goody was checking that there was actually somebody in here.
That's nice. I feel safer.
Yeah.
So fundamentally, it's not a case of anything we're doing. We're already trying to do that, attract people in. And with the recent announcements and changes in the sector where district councils may be wound up in 2 years, I don't know how you recruit anybody to councils when you're telling them the organisation may disappear, they won't have a job shortly. Why would they leave a permanent job? Why would they not join a unitary instead? All the uncertainty that's being created makes us ever less desirable. We are paying off, we're under a lot of pressure, you might not be guaranteed a job, you could earn more at work, a lot less somewhere else. We're starting to struggle.
Yeah.
And the LGA SIPA paper didn't really answer those questions. I do encourage people to read it because it was meant to be the answer to the solution. But it says things like, make yourselves more desirable without being clear, pay them more, but you can't go over your pay scales, see if you can do something else. just like, okay, thank you. I know this is recorded, but this is genuinely a reflection of what was said.
And then, thank you. And then, if you're training them, they will leave after the training.
Yes, unfortunately, I left my training contract when I finished at Wolverhampton, and I went down to run a council, so yes.
Yeah.
I was going to say, if we're coming into the authority, won't they take all the staff on when you're not necessarily going to get made redundant, are you? Because you still need their job to do it, so there might be chance then for, I don't know, a new role or something.
Purely guesswork at the moment. We don't know any of this, we're waiting for the policy statement. It's just, it's been hypothecated. If we went to a unitary model, then what the government has been putting out is they need to make substantial savings in that movement to that model. So it's public domain. So for example, Tim earns about 140. A chief executive off of a large unitary will earn 230 plus. So to get the savings you need, you would think deleting all the chief execs would generate that, but they wouldn't necessarily generate the savings sufficiently to make it stick. So you, in terms of the junior staff and everyone else, that's where you're going to have to do it at every tier to make the set kind of savings they're looking at from the initial documents. Mm. So. None of this is certain, this is all hypothecated, back-channeling discussions and theorising. Generally, we can look at Northamptonshire, when they did their split into two new unitaries, we saw substantial reduction in staffing headcounts across the two. So while some will survive, you can't guarantee who it will be, and you can't guarantee what your new T's and C's will be afterwards. So you can tube it across for a bit, probably, and then you'll be protected for a bit if you make the cut.
Will there still be a labour shortage though, whether you can recruit anybody to the unitary authority, you know?
Yes, fundamentally you still have the same kind of workload. The question is, would you stop, again I'm just guessing out there, but would you stop delivering certain services that we currently do as a district and focus more on social care, where the big budget gaps are? You take money from our outreach, our wellbeing programmes and so on. They're not statutory, so you cut those, you freed up that budget, you push it into social care. You don't need those staff because you're not delivering that service. You can bring in more social workers. And again, this is pure guesswork based on what's been released. I encourage everyone to read the documents that have been published since the autumn budget themselves and see what they think of it. But there is clear indications that they're looking at this model. The District Council's network, I don't know if anyone's members of that and reads their publications, they're putting out some nervous materials around this as well. So it's not just me speaking and guessing and creating fear. So I encourage you guys to read this as well and read your own conclusions. I'm just saying that these are possibilities.
Yeah. My experience of industry that did very similar things, there was sometimes a push towards centralisation, which it means, in our terms, unitary authorities. They then found out all the disadvantages of that, and there was a move towards empowerment at the local level, which is moving back to district authorities and even local ward authorities to deliver services where local people were doing against local problems. And then after a while somebody starts talking about postcode lotteries and how it's different in different places what the service is, and there's then a pushback for centralisation again. There's not a lot new in the world. It looks like we might be in part of a cycle where we're going to centralise a bit more and try and get some savings from removing overlaps, which may at the moment cause friction and wasted time. And wasted time means having too many people concentrating on the same thing. Probably not too much overall good, where centralisation does help, but who knows, we'll tell you in a decade's time.
So it is on the front page of the District Council's network, back page at the moment if you want to read it. It is a response to the budget they published on the 30th of October 2024, so it isn't just me just speaking.
Yeah.
So please read that.
Thank you, Chris. Okay, if there are no other questions.
Page 190, Chairman. That's where the recommendation is.
The recommendation's on page 190. to note the risk management policy and strategy set out in Appendix 1. And point 2.2 is to note the risk appetite statement and set the risk appetite at moderate. Do I have a proposer? Seconder? Thank you. So noted, items 2.1.2.2 on page 190.
2.10, Chairman.
2.10 next. Some in the right place. So this we're looking now at the specific risk register that's set at the 30th of September 24, and the recommendation is that the committee note the draft risk strategic risk register and considers the progress made in the identification and management of the strategic risks.
Thank you, Chair. I'll take members through this. Essentially, this is the half-year update of the risk register that came to members at the June meeting, which was the April position. There isn't a lot of movement in terms of the risks that are on there and the risk scores that are set out. And the table at 2.14, it just gives you that high-level summary of each risk and where it is at. That's not to say that the risks aren't moving. The following pages do set out individual summaries and progress summaries showing that there is action within some of the recommendations. It's just that those actions aren't significant enough to change the risk scores. That isn't necessarily a negative thing in its own right as well, because some of these risks are elements that are almost partly outside of our control. The external financial situation being one of them, the capacity issues that we're facing are more systemic across the sector as well, so they are things that we can easily and quickly resolve, so we wouldn't necessarily expect a lot of movement with them. The key thing to draw members' attention to is the new risk that has been added specifically around town centre regeneration projects, and the more detail around that is set out on page 224, I think it is, of the agenda, and that has been brought into focus on that town centre regeneration projects. The big scale of that is the significant impact it is having on the wider council in terms of resources, time and effort that is going into those, and to show that they are that those projects in their own right are significant issues. They have previously been in there, but as part of the economy risk that's in there,
yeah,
and looking to do those. But we felt now they're actually hitting the ground, we're starting to see movement, work is going to start on those in the near future, that it did need a dedicated risk. And that is the big one at the moment. As I say, that's come in as a 15, which is a red risk. And again, I think it probably reflects where we're at in terms of those schemes, in terms of approval for variations and things like that, not being quite as tied down as we would have liked, because central government are unwilling at this point in time to put a lot of things in writing. And also the fact that we're about to hit the ground, so there might be other things coming out of the woodwork that haven't been considered. The rest of the risks, as I say, have got progress updates, have got movement, but the information is there for members to see in the report. So I think that's all I want to say on this item, but I'm happy to take any questions or comments from members.
Yep.
Thank you. I've got a question about the risk. Reference C2 economic risk. I don't know what it is.
What page are you on? Is it page
216, yes.
Yeah.
Because the explanation, I don't, it's just about the local plan.
If I may, Chair, it's wider than that. So it's around the work that the council is doing to try and safeguard the economy of the borough. So it's things like the investment in infrastructure support for businesses, economic support. So it's not the local plan itself. That's more a sort of structural planning issue. So it wouldn't really feature in here, although elements of the local plan obviously influence that. Yeah. It is more about our direct support for businesses, so how we're really supporting them. As I say, the regeneration project would have been captured in this risk up to this point before we pulled them out as well.
Okay. Sorry, Angela. Yeah.
Thank you. Can I just ask, you know, page 217, we have a copy about the legal labour and. Stephen, you did see quite a lot of these risks we've had before, and a lot of them are still ongoing. But this one I'm interested in, and that is, we were talking about freedom of labour and the fact that they are still a slight risk to us. But it does tell us there that we do have an open book approach with freedom of labour. And I just wanted some kind of assurance that there is someone who is looking at the accounts of freedom of labour. That we are having, for example, a cabinet member or an officer who are looking at the accounts for Freedom Leisure, because it's pleasing to note that we did give a lot of support to Freedom Leisure in the past, and I think we're actually going to give them more support now that it comes to, we're looking at giving them panels and looking at that.
So,
and I just wondered, are we still that someone who is looking at Freedom Leisure's books?
If I may, Chair, I think I might defer to Chris on this in terms of the actual financial monitoring.
Yeah.
I think the one comment, I think I will caveat that, the open book accounting was more around the post-COVID support with Freedom Leisure, and I believe that isn't ongoing at the moment.
So, Chair, Anna has brought in additional resources to monitor the contract and its performance now.
Right.
So that's a new appointment to her team. So they'll be taking the reins on this and monitoring it effectively and make sure we drive out the value and hold them to it. So it is a relatively new appointment. She's just finding her feet at the moment. Met her yesterday.
Yeah.
I think I was introduced to her yesterday. So that should take that pressure off and give you that reassurance. I'm very glad we brought this resource in, I have to say.
Right, I just wanted to reset particularly cabinet members here. Thank you, Chair.
Chairman, Councillor Rose.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. It's not necessarily a question about what's on the list, but it's more about what could be on it. So I was wondering, do we think that climate change should be added as a risk, considering the increased likelihood of floods and other extreme weather events? Because I know, particularly in my ward, the village of Church Eaton experiences really bad flooding, and sometimes it's like impossible to leave the village in anything less than a tractor or a 4x4 for sometimes 2 or 3 days at a time. So events such as these obviously affect residents' abilities to get to work, to get to the doctors, to get to the shops. It also prevents Veolia's workers' ability to get there, although there's never actually been a flood on the bin collection day so far, so it's worked out so far from, but obviously there is this increased risk in the future. And ultimately it threatens the corporate business objectives of the Borough Council, in that some residents are essentially extremely isolated.
Okay, if I may, I can start a little bit on that. In terms of what isn't on there and whether climate change is on there, the leadership team have regular discussions on this. Every time we bring an update, there are discussions around what should be on there, is there anything new, are there elements. I think it's always a difficult one. It's something Judith and I have had conversations with in terms of fairly recently, in terms of emergency planning and the CCU's the community risk register, where there are higher impact things on there. This risk register is about achieving our objectives in their own right, and whilst some of those things, the flooding and that, can impact it at a lower level, it's whether it's impacting us at a strategic level, and that's the things that we do need to take into account. But there are discussions about whether climate change should be on there. It's probably going to be more about the council's ability to deliver our climate change objectives rather than anything else. But I think Judith will probably, and maybe Chris add in a little bit more if there is anything.
I was just going to do it more around the latter point that's been made, which was, because we have a corporate priority that's around the delivery of the of certain actions to mitigate against the risk of climate change, what we look more to do is to focus on what might stop us from achieving that priority. So there is actually a strategy being worked on and a delivery plan. I think when we've got that, we'll then be able to form a view about how we might frame something in a risk sense that isn't about the risk of climate change, but more about why we might not achieve the strategy, the actions that are set out in that plan. So that's a piece of work that we're waiting on is due out shortly.
I think if I may to name that, the example, the similar example that has been on there for a while is the cyber risk that we have. Because we used to have a risk worded around the lines of that we try and prevent a cyber attack. Actually, we're unlikely to be able to prevent it fully. So the risk has moved now to being able to mitigate and respond to an attack when it does happen, because it's a reality that we will have cyber attacks. We're never going to avoid that. Climate change is probably a similar type of thing. If it does feature on the risk register, it won't be so much about preventing climate change, because I'm not sure we can prevent it now. It is a reality we're facing. So it's about how we respond and react to the impact on the council, and if it does feature on the strategic risk strategy, I think it will be more couched in that way than preventing climate change, because there is an argument in risk management that if something is a reality, it shouldn't be on your risk register anyway, because it's about risk that may happen rather than things that are already happening. But likewise, we should have things elsewhere in performance reporting, in plan delivery monitoring and performance monitoring in that way that will feature as well. So these things will all come together, and members should see them not individually in isolation, but it's on the risk register or it's on a performance report. It's what does that big picture tell you about how we're dealing with the climate change that we're facing and the impact on our residents.
That's great, thank you very much.
It's actually quite a good point, because we've seen a lot of press reports about some local areas in Spain, for instance, who have a warning system that's run by the local councils in terms of specific risks, and the fact that they weren't very good at actually operating them, and it cost a lot of people their lives. And whether we've really have got anything of that scale that we need to worry about. I can't think of any. I don't know if anybody in Church Eaton's likely to be at risk from flooding.
Well, there is a few houses that do flood, so it's not life threat. Well, it depends obviously on who it is, but it's not immediately life threatening on a basis, but it has the potential to obviously.
And if I may, Chair, I think it depends on the nature of the flooding, because there's surface flooding and then there's river flooding as well. Yeah. And we do have areas in the district that do that, and actually that's the Environment Agency's responsibility, and they do have flood warnings for river flooding and things like that. But actually, where it's surface flooding, drainage, other areas that just can't cope in certain areas, which we have seen, it's always hard to predict. And it's where is it our responsibility? Where is it the county's responsibility? And
some dread to.
Yes, it's a minefield in the UK how things are spread out around different agencies as to who is the right person.
Yeah.
I think all we can do is reflect on our risk register, the things that are important to the district that are in our control, and to make sure that we manage those risks. And I think that's the key element.
Thank you very much. So that was the strategic risk register, item 3D.
To the recommendations on page 210.
210. And consider the progress made in the identification and management of the strategic risks. So, are we duly noted?
Yeah, I'll propose that.
Thank you, Angela. Okay, thank you very much. All in favour? Unanimous, Jim.
Thank you. Now we jump to page 225, Chair.
225, VFM progress.
Thank you, Yeah, I'll pick that one up. So at the end of quarter two, in summary, we've had a 50-50 in terms of our progress. We are continuing to make steady progress on delivering the actions set out in the improvement plan. But it is fair to say there has been some slippage. And it's where we're at this point is we've managed to catch up on pretty much all of the actions from quarter four of last year. We're making very good progress now on the actions from quarter one of this year, but that's then had a kind of a knock-on effect to our progress in quarter two. What we have done, we've been talking to the external auditors, and as Chris alluded to earlier when we were talking about the statement of accounts, I think they're starting to recognise that this isn't something that we're going to fix quickly, it is going to take a bit more time. So what we've done, we've taken the opportunity to look at that plan and reprofile it, and we're making use now of the whole of 25-26. We'd only allowed a few actions to slip into that previously, but what we've done now is we've spread them out more evenly over 25-26, recognising the capacity we've got, and hopefully that will make it more achievable for us. It's still going to be quite challenging, but I'd say I think we have a better chance now of delivering to those reprofiled quarters.
This is the summary of progress table one, is it, on 226?
And as you've seen tonight, actually, the risk management policy and strategy is one that actually in this report is showing us, yes, we've made some progress, but we haven't completed it. But so you'll see that move through in the quarter three report, that we are continuing to deliver against that plan and make progress on the actions. So we seem to be able to swell around the IT risks. So the IT actions, we're starting to deliver on those as well. This is to make progress on some of the finance ones. There are still some big pieces of work to be done, but as I say, we are steadily working our way through the improvement plan. And it does provide us with a very good framework for keeping a track of what needs to be done.
Well, are there any questions on the VFM improvement plan? So we are actually to note the progress.
Right, progress noted, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Annual Ripper review on page 250-252. We are asked to note the report. Are you taking us through this as well, Judith?
We can do, Chair. There isn't really a lot to say. It is a matter of formality, really, that we as best practice to bring this to you to have a look at. The reality is there are regulations there that if we undertake a particular type of surveillance that's covert, that's not obviously the person that we're investigating, then we have to follow certain sort of rules and protocols for that. In reality, for this council, that is something we very rarely do. The report is saying to you that we haven't done any of those types of investigations in the last 12 months.
Right.
But it is just to reassure members that we do have those processes in place and a policy that protects the council if we have to use those in hours. But so there's not really much in there, it's just a matter of note.
Jim.
Did you ever like investigate benefit fraud or anything like that? Is that what it would be used for? Do you not do it or not?
No longer. We used to, but most of the workers gradually moved back over to the DWP with universal credit. So I'd say we don't tend to get involved in that.
Right, council tax benefit or housing benefit or anything like that?
Some limited involvement around council tax benefit. So yes, we have some residual around that, and you know, there are other kind of aspects of fraud that might occur in the council. But I'd say it's not something we get involved in that often. And where we do have investigations, we try to be quite overt in our approach to it, so it doesn't require you to use these powers. These sort of powers are more typically used by the police and the bigger enforcement agencies. I think whilst there's a protocol set out in there for a couple of officers who are trained to make those decisions, we can't make that full decision. It has to go to the magistrate court for them to decide whether we can exercise those powers. So I say we'll always try and find a way of doing it in a different way to be more overt about it.
Do we have any continuing involvement in the town centre CCTV?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, we still provide it.
We're just providing them with home, basically.
Yes, what we would then get is potentially requests from the likes of the police to access the footage to
right.
Identify suspects from crimes. But then that's not us doing that, so we'll get a request and we should provide the access to the footage.
Right. It used to be something that came up quite regularly a while ago. I just remember we've not heard anything about it recently.
There will still be those requests.
Yeah.
So if you're in at the right time of day, sometimes you'll see a police officer come into the building and making their way to the CCTV room.
Right.
We did hear about it here at the time of the bowling match, where there was kids who ran
on the bowling green.
And in actual fact, when we looked at the CCTV, the police actually identified the culprits.
Mm. Right.
So it does get
used. Yeah, it does get used, yeah.
And it can be used to our benefit as well.
Yeah. Do we have any involvement in actually maintaining equipment or anything?
We do fund that, don't we?
Yeah.
We do. I think we get grant funding
and
we're happy for it as well, yes.
Right. So we do have a physical involvement in maintaining equipment, presumably through Street Scene?
Yeah. A contractor.
Yeah. Right then, we're just noting this report. If anybody's got any other questions? If not, we seem to be done, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for everybody for making their way through the inclement weather. Hope yours wasn't quite as inclement as mine is up in Fulford, where we've still got 4 inches of snow.